Tonight on Arena, Ruth Negga on Oscar nominations, Memories of Love Hate, and her new film, Passing. And Sinead Gleeson reviews Claire Keegan's latest book, Small Things Like These. Ruth Negga, known for her Oscar-nominated role in the film Loving, as well as screen roles in Breakfast on Pluto and Love Hate, and on stage in recent times as Hamlet in the Gate Theatre, stars in the directorial debut of actress Rebecca Hall. Passing is the film. Was shot in black and white, also stars Tessa Thompson and Alexander Skarsgård. In the film, Ruth plays Claire Kendry, a light-skinned biracial woman who passes for white, even to the point of marrying a white racist husband. Acclaimed on its premiere at the 2021 Sundance Film Festival, the film is adapted from the celebrated 1929 novel of the same name by Nella Larsen. I'm delighted to have Ruth Negga with me in studio. This is quite an extraordinary novel, I think, to start out with, and film that has been mined out of it. You read the novel a long, long time ago, I believe, Ruth.
I read the novel, yeah, Nella Larsen's novella. It's very short. It was first published in 1929. And I was just struck by the modernity of it. I was very interested in how it explores identity and the nature of female friendship. And when Rebecca told me she was wanting to adapt it, and I was thrilled and I jumped to the chance.
She came to you. There are two women really at the heart of the story. Claire Kendry, the character you play, and the other character, Irene, played by Tessa Thompson. When she came to you first, when Rebecca came to you first, was it Irene that she was actually talking to you about?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Irene is definitely the more repressed of the two women. She is a pillar in her community, in the black community, and she's a wife and mother, and that very much forms the basis of her identity. And I think she saw me as Mildred Loving, and you know, they have kind of that's a similar sort of energy, but actually they're actually quite different. But I was very drawn to Claire's magnetism and her audacity, really. She's capricious, she's charismatic, and she's also quite irritating. And I loved that Nella Larsen reserved judgment on her.
Right.
And I just was, basically my curiosity got the better of me and I wanted to connect with this woman and see how I would play her and how she would change me.
Yeah, so both things were involved. Let's have a listen to a clip. This is from quite early on in the film, actually. Irene, played by Tessa Thompson, she sees this woman staring across at her and is wondering, why is she staring at me and why is she looking at me? And then you, as Claire, come over and you start up a conversation.
Pardon me, I don't mean to stare, but I think I know you.
I'm afraid you're mistaken.
No, of course I know you, Renee. You look just the same. Tell me, do they still call you Renee?
Yes, though no one's called me that for a long time.
Don't you know me? Not really, Renee.
I'm afraid I can't seem to place. Claire?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Not Claire Kendry.
Mm-hmm. Now don't run away. You simply must stay and talk.
Fancy meeting you here. It's simply too lucky. It's awfully surprising, yes. I'd never have known you if you hadn't laughed. You've changed so.
Well, it's been 12 years at least. You know, I almost dropped by your father's house not so long ago. I've thought of you so often.
You have?
Of course. You know, since I've been here, I've hoped I might run into someone. Preferably you, though. Well, now you're here. I'll wager you haven't given me a thought.
And that's Ruth Negga as the character Claire, and Tessa Thompson playing Renee or Irene in a clip there from the film Passing, and Ruth Negga with me in studio on Arena this evening.
That laugh is what how Rini recognises her again, Ruth, even in the midst of that clip. She's saying the capricious nature comes across there. But this idea that she's passing, the title of the film, that she's passing as a white woman, just explain a little bit around that and how prevalent it was, particularly when the novella was written.
So passing is a theme that is very common in America, but not talked about. There's a lot of silence around it, a conspiracy of silence, if you will, I think because it's seen as taboo. But it was something that, I suppose, many ways a privilege that was afforded to light-skinned African-Americans, where they could assimilate into the white community and leave their blackness behind, and people did that for various reasons, economic necessity, opportunity, really access to what they were denied as black people. And often that was, a lot of people saw that as a way out, if you will, slavery, the deconstruction of the reconstruction, the black codes, Jim Crow. And it happened a lot, but of course, because it was a secret, it became taboo and not talked about. So often people would disappear from their communities. And with the aid of the black community, who kept the secret. And so there's a psychological burden on both the community and the person passing. And a lot of people never returned to their communities. There was a severance of sorts. And this is an exploration of that and how that psychologically leaves a human being when they have to deny such a crucial part of their identity.
Yeah, and you said when you were talking about Nella Larson and the novella that she reserves judgment. She doesn't make any judgment on any of the characters. And there are lots of the characters you could get annoyed at for many reasons. Yet you, when you were talking about Claire, the character, you said she's irritating as well as all the great things that she is. What's that balance between, you know, knowing that she's irritating as the person playing her and still having to reserve judgment as the novelist does?
What, as playing her?
Yeah.
Well, you know, really the onus is on the collective, the ensemble, you know. I mean, I'm relying on the other actors and their great talents to sort of construct that for me, you know. It's through Irene's eyes that you see Claire, and she is unreliable. So you don't know if you're getting, you know, the real Claire often, you know. So, you know, her charisma is really dependent on the other characters. Her, I suppose, her power is having power over others. And there's a performative quality to that. But really, she is, as much as she's the one passing, really it's Irene that is wearing the many masks and passing as various things, you know, and Claire's entry into her world is sort of a catalyst for Irene as she realises that she's not really living a true, authentic life as herself. She's all of these other things. She finds her self-esteem in her goodness. And I think that's a very precarious place to put your value as a human being.
You mentioned Mildred Loving, the character for which you were Oscar nominated. I know I spoke to you around the time of that of that film. You weren't Oscar nominated at that time. Can I remind you of the performance by taking a scene from the film? Joel Edgerton here playing the man to whom it's Richard Loving. Mildred and Richard were married in real life. It's a true story. And here he is making his proposal to you as Mildred.
I want to put the kitchen back here.
Richard, stop this. I don't know what you're saying.
I bought it. This whole acre. I'm gonna build you a house. Right here.
Yes.
Would you marry me?
Joel Edgerton and Ruth Negga there in a scene from Loving. How could anybody refuse a proposal like that, Ruth? But Oscar nominated for that. That, I presume, has changed, or has it? What way does it change, not necessarily in the way you're going to play anything, but in career terms, what does it mean?
I really don't know how to answer that question because, you know, when offers come in, I don't know how much that's motivated by the performances I've done or, you know, the Oscar nomination. I'm sure it helps, you know, and like, I don't know. And I suppose, you know, you're... value goes up as an actor. I don't really know anything about those things.
But you I think you're now a member of the Academy, so will you be involved in the voting for the Oscars? What kind of ideas will you bring to that process? You know, there's been lots of talk about, you know, the lack of diversity in recent times. What are you hoping to bring to that process?
Me, myself, and I. I don't know. I mean, you know, the thing is that I don't really know what goes on in the corridors of power. You know, just because people like me are being talked about doesn't mean that we're doing the talking, you know. It's about opportunity and access, you know. It's about people who green light things. I mean, you know, we need to have diverse people in positions of power. I mean, it's kind of that simple.
Yeah, and I suppose you're bringing a certain life experience to it as well. You know, given your background, and you've spoken about this before, your Irish-Ethiopian background and growing up in Limerick. Do you think that feeds into even the choices you make as an actor?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, acting is a deeply personal thing and you bring your own experiences. That what's hard is to sort of separate out all those different things and how they contribute. It's not something I think about consciously, but of course I carry myself everywhere with me.
I want to give you a little bit of a trip down memory lane. Have a listen to this.
Hey.
Rosie, I'm so sorry I'm late. I've been waiting long.
You're grand. I'm only off the bus there now.
I was halfway out to the airport.
I told you I was getting the bus.
Sorry.
Relax, you're here now. Why are you smiling now?
Is this all you have?
Yeah. Travelling light, I am.
But you are staying.
Yeah. All I really had was a telly. Let me flatmate keep it.
Try have a telly.
Do you?
Yeah. Yeah, you can come around and watch it if you want.
Maybe I will.
Got all the channels and everything. So was your ma expecting you today?
Today or tomorrow?
I should be upset if you didn't turn up.
Why? You thinking of kidnapping me?
Yeah, maybe I am.
Making me walk the plank.
Yeah, I might have to tie you up first.
I'll have to let you first. We go for a drink?
Yeah, for sure. Where do you want to go?
You got any beers back at yours?
Yeah, I've got beer, vodka, whatever you want. I've got a full bar license.
Yeah? Go get me drunk, so. What?
Nothing.
There you go, Rosie and Darren, of course, yourself, Ruth Negga, and Robert Sheehan as Darren. And season two, I think that was, of Love Hate.
Yeah.
That's nearly 10 years ago now.
I think it is 10 years, yeah.
A lot of water, obviously, has gone under the bridge since then. But that, had you a sense during that series, Ruth, of just, because obviously it was huge in terms of this country. The entire season, all seasons were repeated recently on RTE television. Had you an idea at the time of what kind of impact it was going to have?
Yeah. So, immediately from Stuart Carlin's writing. It was extraordinary and unique and original and genuine and when you've got writing like that that's deceptively simple, it's really easy to just, you know, do. And then of course Robbie Sheehan, you know, it was a lovely dance he did, you know, and it's, you know, it takes two to generate chemistry, and that's what I love about my job, you know. It's like it's acting is an ensemble thing, you know, and that means everybody, like the writer, the actors, the crew, the cast and everything. And I think everyone knew how special it was, and we all had a ball.
Yeah, and I suppose you carry those experiences and you're looking for the same thing then.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, that's what you look for, is the people.
And then so Preacher, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Misfits, the big TV series that you've been part of. Dominic Cooper and Joe Gielgud have been part of both. Joe in terms of Misfits, wasn't it? Dominic in terms of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And then the two of them together in Preacher. That must bring, must be great fun to kind of build that type of ensemble relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I miss the boys terribly. I mean, we laughed a lot on Preacher. You know, and that's, you know, when you're far when you're far away from home and you're filming, you do rely on your cast and your crew to be your family, and it's you know, you make deep, long lasting friendships.
Let's listen to a little bit of Preacher, and it's yourself and the two boys.
Hey.
Hey.
How are you feeling?
Better than you look. What happened to your face?
You might have missed a couple of fights where you were out.
Yeah, you got the worst of everyone, didn't you?
Seriously, how you feel?
Nothing out, chair I won't fix.
What was it like?
I've already asked her. She doesn't remember.
Nothing?
No harps. No talking to her.
Cass reckons he'll come back eventually.
Well, I'm glad you came back.
Yeah, me too.
To the end of the world, right?
To the end of the world.
You gonna tell him what happened? It was your friends who killed Chula. The lads in the white suits, Jess.
The Grail?
Yeah, your BR Messiah friends.
They're not my friends.
Whatever they are, Chula caught on to him. That girl now, what's her name now?
Jenny.
That's it.
That mom hair lying bitch.
Who's Jenny?
Bloody Jenny, the neighbor lady.
It's true, Jesse. They were screwing with us this whole time.
Right, so what are we waiting for? Let's go and get those dickheads right now. What? You don't want to get your friends who killed Chula.
Stop calling them my friends. I just need a minute to work things out here, all right? Besides, you need to get some rest.
You look all right to me. I'm ready to go right now.
I said I need a minute.
But I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to Chula.
Hey! What is up with you guys?
Ruth Negga, Dominic Cooper and Joe Gilgan there in it, the scene from Preacher. Just to go back then, Ruth Negga, to passing and this working with Rebecca Hall. Mm. Rebecca Hall, who people will know, the daughter of Peter Hall, very famous theatre director. And she really, as an actress, many people will know her up to this point. You know, when she said she wanted to direct this, what was it about what she was saying about the script and about the adaptation, which she did, that made you want to be part of it? Because it was a pretty immediate yes, I think.
Oh, yeah.
On your part.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a very big fan of Rebecca's for a very long time. And, you know, she blends deep intelligence with deep sensitivity and all those qualities. You know, and her being an actress, I love working with other actors. And I think there's a shorthand that we develop and a sort of an eschewing of unnecessary politeness. And, you know, I think, you know, she understands what actors really love is when you're trusted. It's a real gift to be trusted. And I think, you know, you repay that gift in kind.
I'm going to finish up with a clip from Passing once again. And you're at the very beginning of this scene, along with Claire's wonderful husband, John, played by Alexander Skarsgård, and Rini, Tessa Thompson, is in here in the midst of all of this again. He has a pet name for her, and I think it's safe for me to say the pet name is Nig, but it's not very difficult to work out what that's an abbreviation for. How difficult are scenes like this? How difficult are those type of ideas to actually, to put them into play and put them out there, even words that none of us want to hear? How important is it that we don't shy away from that?
Well, I don't think we need to be bandying around like words like that, left, right and centre. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a real punch in the gut when you hear that word. And it was a punch in the gut definitely for all of us. But, you know, that's my job, isn't it? Mm. My job is to translate that, all those feelings. And, you know, I think, you know, it is the job of art to make us uncomfortable, and with that uncomfortableness sort of have an internal dialogue and conversation with ourselves. You know, my job is to move people, and it's not just, you know, emotionally to tears or something. It's to challenge people's perceptions of the truth. And, you know, and I think artists are disruptors, you know, and I think those kind of scenes should disrupt people out of their comfort zones to question their own sort of responsibilities as a community to one another.
Ruth, lovely to talk to you again.
Thank
Congratulations.
You.
Ongoing success, and I hope it continues the star to be in the ascendant. Thanks
Thank
for being
you. I
with
appreciate
us.
That.
And we'll finish with that clip. Tessa Thompson as Rini, Alexander Skarsgård as John, and the first voice you will hear that of Ruth Negga as Claire.
After all these years, what would it matter if you found out that I was 1 or 2% colored,
Well, you can turn as black as you please as far as I'm concerned. I know you're not colored.
So you dislike Negroes, Mr. Bellew?
No, 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 not at all. I hate them. But not as much as Nig does, for all she's trying to turn into one. Well, she won't have them near her, not even as a maid. Isn't that true?
Have you ever known any Negroes?
No, 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 no. But I do know people who know them. And I read about them in the papers, of course. It's a terrible mess. Robbing, killing. It's sad, really.
John, Rini doesn't want to hear about your pet perversions.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bore you, Mrs. Redfield. You live nearby?
Fairly.
It's a great city, New York. City of the future. What line of work is your husband in?
He's a doctor.
It's an interesting life, a doctor, isn't it?
Yes. Hard, nerve-wracking, too.
Oh, wife's nerves, too, I bet. All those lady patients.
John, dear, don't start. More tea, Rainey?
I've taken up too much of your time already.
Oh, but we're just getting started.
Thank you for the drink, Claire.
I'll see you out.
Tessa Thompson there as Irene Redfield, Alexander Skarsgård as John Bellew, and Ruth Nig as his wife Claire in the film Passing. And Passing will be in Irish cinemas on October the 29th, followed by its release on Netflix on November the 10th. And indeed, Ruth has received a Spotlight Award at the 24th SCAD Savannah Film Festival for the role of Claire in Passing, and enjoying that text there. I love Ruth Nega, says our texter. Didn't notice you didn't mention my favourite character of hers, Tulip from Preacher. Obviously, just before we played the clip, that text was sent to us. So, Passing, Netflix, November the 10th, cinemas, October the 29th. Just gone 7:30 on Tuesday night, Serena. In October, there were yellow trees. So, with a sentence of just 6 words, begins Small Things Like These, the new novel from Claire Keegan. It's her first book since the acclaimed short novel Foster in 2010. Set in 1985, Small Things Like These tells the story of Bill Forlong, a coal and timber merchant in New Ross County, Wexford, under pressure in one of the busiest periods of his year, the days running up to Christmas. Bill is a family man, happily married with 5 daughters, but his past is a little bit more complicated, and it's on his mind as he makes his deliveries. Sinead Gleeson has been reading Small Things Like These for us, and she joins me now on the line. I suppose, Sinead, a new book from Claire Keegan is always has a sense of occasion about it, because she certainly doesn't rush into publication.
No, she doesn't. And again, there's a handful of collections. There is Foster, which some people would describe as a novella or extended short story. And I remember hearing about that there was a book on the way maybe 9-10 years ago. But I think anybody who knows and is intimately acquainted with her work knows that there is a precision and a kind of thoughtfulness in terms of how she selects words and sentences. I know people who've done her creative writing classes who say the same thing, that she's all about economy and about, you know, removing and excising things that don't need to be there. And I think this book is very much a case in point. I'd say it was something that was, given the subject matter and the politics of this book, I'd say it was something that you kind of ruminated on very deeply. So possibly that's why it took a while to get to us.
Yeah, and you mentioned the fact that in the case of Foster from 2010, you could debate whether it's a novel or a novella. We're in a similar type of category here. It is quite a short and concise book.
It's extremely pithy. I think it's 96 pages, which puts it, you know, it's definitely a one sitting read if you want to. And, you know, that kind of phrase can sometimes undermine what the capabilities of a book are, to kind of sit down and immerse yourself. But it is an extremely immersive book. As you mentioned in the introduction, it's set in one place. It's set over a short period of time. It concerns a small cast of characters. So the kind of brevity of the book suits the kind of setting and the amount of small group of people we're dealing with in this book. It actually works.
Not least of the challenges that Claire Keegan has set herself in this case is that the central character of Bill Forlong, he's a good man, and writing good or writing white is often quite difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, particularly as he's a good parent, and as anyone who's familiar with Keegan's past work will know that there are a lot of terrible or kind of unforgiving and harsh parents in her previous work. But he is a very good man. He's a family man. He doesn't have very much. He has this business. It's very manual and difficult work. But he loves his daughters. He loves his wife, and he doesn't want very much in life. And yet, at the same time, we run into danger sometimes in fiction and in Irish fiction of the kind of the kindly rural trope of the man who doesn't doesn't have much of a life. But Keegan, to her credit, does give him a kind of an interior life where he's questioning things. He's looking at, you know, he asks himself, you know, in one occasion, what was it all for? Might things never change or develop into something else? So there's a depth to him that he's not just this kind of bumbling, kindly, avuncular sort of figure. He does have, there's a lot going on, which I think also helps set a big part of the plot in this book in motion.
And the other aspect of that, you say that he's a good parent, but parenthood is a very important part of the story.
It very much is, because he has his own children, obviously, but what happens in this book is that his delivery route takes him up to the local convent. And at the time, as we know, in various places all over the country, there were Magdalen laundries, and he becomes aware of seeing girls who he sees his own daughters in these girls who are, he describes them as scrubbing floors in filthy clothes. One girl is accidentally, so the mother superior says, locked in a coal shed while playing hide and seek, but it becomes very clear to him that's not what's going on. And the conflict, I think, in a lot of the story is the people outside of that setting of the laundry and the nuns and Bill, his family and the broader community, and who they know or what they know about what's going on and how people respond to what's going on up the road in the big convent, so to speak.
And when you make that description of him going past this particular place on his rounds, we think, oh yeah, what year are we in? We're in 1985.
You know, Sean, actually, somebody pointed out to me that yesterday was the, in 1996, on the 25th of October, was the closure of the last Magdalen laundry in Ireland. It's Sean McDermott Street. So we're not that far away. And yet this book does feel it's 1985. And reading it feels like, you know, 1935 or 1955. It's quite sepia tinted. And I think this is very deliberate on Keegan's part. He's trying to remind us that these awful things happened, you know, not 60 years ago. They happened in living memory. They happened to, you know, I would have been in you know, a very young girl at that time. And I think that she's reminding us that these awful things are not historical. They were still living and presented as a thing that was going on until very recently. So the book feels quite old and old-fashioned in terms of the setting, but it's not at all in terms of its politics and the points that Keegan's trying to make.
What kind of place is New Ross in 1985? I guess it could stand in for any small Irish town. It's not particularly New Ross that she's picking on in some ways here. It's an example, I presume.
Very much so. I mean, she's painting that picture, as you could imagine, of 1985 Ireland. It's a time of recession and poverty, immigration. You know, she does very cleverly sort of just mention little sort of background things. So there's references to Hawhey, to, you know, to moving statues, to all the young people leaving, to negotiations about the north of Ireland. And they're filtered in kind of in the background, could have been overdone. It's not heavy handed, because what Keegan is trying to tell us all the time is that this is Bill Forlong's story. This isn't a story about the broader look at Irish society. I'm going to look at a specific part of it, but I want you to focus on this man and the conflict in his life arising out of what he sees up the road at the convent.
Keegan dedicates the book to a quote to the women and children who suffered in Ireland's Magdalen laundries. Obviously that side of the story is very important, but how does she treat the church and how does she tell the church's side of the story, if there is a side to be told here?
Well, it's funny. I mean, you could be very dogmatic in a book like this, and you know, you could trot out the sort of the church is evil, and again, she is very good at maintaining not just the cruelty of the nuns to the girls, but also the weariness of the women who work for the nuns. So she's very good on the hierarchies in terms of all the denominations of who's at the top and who's at the bottom. In terms of the cruelty is very, very stark in terms of what the girls are denied. One girl asks Bill to take her to the river so that she can drown herself because she has had her child taken away, and she wants to be reunited with them. So the nuns, I mean, there's callousness, there's secrecy, they're telling lies themselves. But what Keegan is trying to say, by rather than just painting the church as evil, she's trying to say that the broader community and the broader town were complicit, because everybody knew what went on up there, but everybody turned a blind eye and people still went to mass. And this becomes Bill's huge conflict in the book. He's a good man. He's a churchgoer. He wants to still, you know, hold on to his faith, but he's conflicted by, you know, what he sees as quite anti-Christian behaviour going on up in what's called, they call it the training school, which is a kind of euphemism for what really was a laundry.
And I'll say 1985 again. I think it's really vital and important that we point out that setting, that the historical setting is not that long ago. I think that's a hugely important aspect of the book. I began with that six-word sentence, and you know, even in that, she paints such a picture with, in October there were yellow trees. I mean, it's very poetic. but it's very direct as well. How would you describe what she does across the 90, what, six pages, I think you said, of the book she did?
Oh, I mean, Keegan is a master of language. It's always exquisite, and she always veers towards the minimal and the unfussy. You know, her sentences, each sentence can stand up by itself and talk to you. They're really impactful. And I think what she's trying to make this book into is it's kind of a fable. It's sort of a morality tale, and it's a novel of conscience in lots of ways, because Bill is the reader's conscience. We're all reading it horrified as well, even though we know what happened. But he decides, his conflict is, will I do something or will I not, and what can one person do in a town where I myself might end up ostracized? And I think her part of the language is also the way that she gives him this interior voice, and he speaks to us, so we side with him in a way in terms of how he's telling us what he's seen and how much it's coming between him and his sleep almost. But yeah, I mean, I think at a language level there isn't really anybody can do what she does in terms of excision and precision and, you know, dilution. Everything that doesn't need to be in this book isn't there. That's why it's the size it is. And I think you have to be a very specific and brilliant kind of writer to pull that off.
Yeah, and I don't want to, I mentioned in the introduction this idea that, you know, Bill, that there's aspects of his past that he's trying to deal with as well. And we obviously don't want to give anything away in that regard. But did that knitting up of past and present, did it work for you in terms of how Kerr Keegan structures the storytelling, if you like?
Yeah, I think so. And I think some of it is kind of left a little bit open to the reader. There are hints earlier on about his father's or Bill's father, who he might be and who the links to the town and all the rest of it. And there is a kind of a revelation towards the end. But by the end of the story, you realise that Bill's parentage is not the story here. The story is what happened in hundreds of towns all over Ireland, where there was a big building where girls lived in misery and nobody did anything about it while still putting coins on the collection plate. And I think that is the bigger part of the story that Keegan is trying to do. And again, the balance is done well in that she isn't kind of forcing her opinion towards us. It's told with story and narrative and a sort of collective look at everybody, the complicity of a large group of people, and it's really well done, I think.
An important novel and an important writer then, I think you're saying overall.
Very much so. And there's a couple of references to Dickens in the book. It's very Christmas Carol-esque in a way. And Bill himself mentions reading David Copperfield as a child. And it does have that Christmas fable. I even had there's a lot of snow towards the end. It reminded me of the dead in a way. Yeah. So the next few couple of months will be a wonderful time to read this book, but also to reflect on what has happened in this country and how it's that not that long ago. And it's too soon to be forgetting and call these things historical. And that's what she does brilliantly.
All right. That's Sinead Gleeson speaking to us about Small Things Like These by Claire Keegan. It's published by Faber. Climate change very much in the headlines today following the publication of the carbon budget plans by the Climate Change Advisory Council. Poet Emma Muldoon Ryan has some interesting things to say about what she calls our toxic relationship.
A toxic relationship. We need to talk. I feel at this point in time that our lives are somewhat adjacent. You're always there for me. You've always been my home, my rock. But to live, I have no choice but to stand on your toes. I'm sorry. See, I'm only continuing on from my predecessors. They've engraved their mantra into my veins and I know nothing else. I'm sorry. You're suffocating, but it's not all me. I've tried to persuade them. I have, I promise. You give me comfort and security, but all I do is give you a headache. I'm so busy, caught up and moving faster and faster all the time, but I just end up eroding parts of you. I'm sorry. I'm sorry I can't take better care of you, but it's not just me you're dealing with. It's an army. It's humanity. We're sorry. We're sorry for setting your forests on fire. We're sorry we've dealt damage to your defense. We're sorry every inch of you reeks of corrupt civilization. Can't you see this relationship, you and I, the one we've had my whole life, our whole life, it's toxic. We've dominated you, knocked you down, and built you back up to our standards. We've manipulated you to work for us and only us. Is this what you've been trying to tell me? All along, these hurricanes, these typhoons, these signs. You knew, didn't you? You knew we'd try to fix canyons with plasters. You knew this was a toxic relationship and you allowed it. You knew this was never going to work and you allowed it.
Emma Muldoon Ryan there with her poem, A Toxic Relationship. And Emma will be performing her poems on Saturday morning, 11:30 at the West End Arts Centre in Mallow, County Cork. This is part of the Mallow Arts Festival. Kicks off tomorrow, Wednesday. Includes live music from Greenshine, The Service and Hank Waddell and Declan Sinnott. And much more besides. You can get full information on their Facebook page, facebook.com/ Mallow Arts Fest. This year, the Imagine Arts Festival in Waterford offered a hybrid programme of online and in-person events, moving on from last year's fully virtual festival. The programme included music, literature, dance, visual art, performance and history, as well as incorporating Waterford Writers' Weekend and the Waterford Poetry Prize. This year's winner of the aforementioned prize was Kildare poet Ingrid Casey with her poem After Lockdown, A Walk on Bray Head. Delighted to be joined this evening by Ingrid Casey, the winning poet, and indeed Colm Keegan, who was the judge on the poetry of the poetry prize. And Colm is with me here in studio. So here come your blushes, Ingrid. You can blush as you're listening to this. This is the second year, Colm, that you've been involved with the Waterford Poetry Prize.
Yeah.
But I want you to tell me, I was watching you doing the announcement of this prize. It was an online announcement.
Yeah.
And I saw you described your reaction when you read Ingrid Casey's poem at home. Yeah. Just tell us what happened.
Well, I was just bowled over by it. I was really genuinely blown away and I was delighted. And the poem is about love and it felt like I was falling in love, you know, with the poem. It's just so beautiful and I was so moved by it. I literally stood up and gave a little bit of a round of applause and I was fist pumping. I was like, yes, because when you're judging a competition, you really are I don't know if it's the same for everyone else, but slightly afraid that you won't see an amazing poem. You know, you really want one that's going to jump above everything else. And you're trawling, you know, like there was 170 poems or something I'm reading and you're going through them all and it's a bit like that scene in Airplane where they're all queuing up to smack the woman and I'm just getting a bang of a poem, getting a bang of another poem and then eventually it's just like, oh my God, this is the one,
let's go back.
The same after that then.
Yeah, okay, I've heard of it. But I have to go back because people say I clapped and I fist pumped. You were at home?
Yeah.
In your bedroom?
Sitting in the bedroom. Just
by yourself?
Trawling through poems.
By yourself?
Yes.
You up with the fist pump and the round of applause.
Oh, big time. Yeah. Because, you know, we've been sitting there for a long time and a good few days. Like I'm reading loads of poems every day and you're, you know, sometimes like you're looking for, well, you know, you have these kind of easy no's, you know, it's just that's definitely like something about it just kicks you out of poem straight away and you're like, okay, it's not going to be that one. And then some you have to go back to them and you read them again and sometimes that's hard work. But then it's just absolutely delighted by this poem. I really was. And to say that I stood up, like, you know that beautiful feeling, like, you talk about your spider senses are tingling. There was kind of a little bit of a rush in the hairs, the goose pimples, you know, and the hairs stand up in your neck. Like, that's really the feeling I got about it. So, yeah, it was definitely, it's an absolute cracker.
You don't get much better reaction than that. And I know you're a student of philosophy. We won't get into the question as to whether if nobody heard the standing ovation, whether it happened or not. But it clearly, the poem had a very strong, got a huge reaction from Colm. What does it feel like to hear that reaction to something you've written yourself?
For me, it's a huge compliment. And it was just, it's funny because I felt like I'd written so little in the past, you know, my debut collection came out in 2018 and then the very beginning of 2020, we went into lockdown and so many things changed. And, you know, I'm just laughing at Colm. I'm like, this is what lockdown has brought us to. We're in our sitting rooms, fist pumping to nobody, like, you know. But lucky for me, I had done a book swap with my neighbour and we totally fell in love. So it brought back maybe a lot of inspiration. I mean, you try to have a practice and you try to force yourself. It's the same with visual artists, I suppose, to do something every day. And it doesn't always work out like that, but it is a really lovely compliment after feeling like I wasn't very productive at all in the past year and a half, you know. But there we have it. We had at least one that shone, so that's great news.
Yeah, and that reaction, as you say, even though you mightn't have seen it and heard it, to know that it happened is hugely gratifying, I'm sure. But there was a little detail within all of that. You, lockdown didn't start, or certainly the period heading into lockdown, it didn't start well for you, Ingrid, before the book swapping. So let's get the far start of the story.
Oh, I was really sick. I had COVID at the very, very beginning of it in the March of that year. Yeah, so I actually realised something about this poem, and on rereading it, that I hadn't realised. It's about the elements, really, and it's about our connection to the earth, because we were out on this walk on Brayhead, having been released from lockdown, and it was a beautiful day, and we were kind of stunned to be, you know, outside, and it was really lovely weather, which isn't always reliable in this part of the world, as we know. But when I was writing I was trying to use themes, and we'd been chatting. We were just, it was kind of, first of all, it was an achievement for me to get up Brayhead with my crappy lungs, because it has been ongoing. You know, I have long COVID, and I've had loads of mysterious lung pain and nerve pain that hasn't, and lots of fatigue and stuff like that. So it was a lovely achievement to fall in love with somebody, but also to be able to go and do something fun with them and not be stuck anymore inside the house, you know, and to feel better. But part of the poem mentions wind, and I was like, I think the winds are evil, and that's like the, you know, they're the threat of illness, if you were kind of studying it, like.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we hear the poem, and we can talk a little bit further about it, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure,
will you read it first? So this is, you've fallen, there's been a book swap with the neighbour, your brother and his wife have been hugely helpful, neighbours have been great, but love has happened in the meantime, after all the COVID.
Yeah.
That's the background.
Yeah. Well, 18 months. Okay, so that's the background. Yeah, so we're 18 months. Well, this would have been spring of 2021. So it's maybe about 6 months ago.
Okay.
So this is after lockdown, a walk on Brayhead. I'll put on my poetry voice now. I'll do my best. Okay. Descending amongst flaming gorse, Ulexi, think of ibex. Think of hearth, heart, earth, old roots, branch, cur. Where live a trinity? Head or horn brings cervix, cerebrum, cornucopia, cranium, keratin. Or to grow, swell, crescere, the waves azure below, a symphony. Then also heat, fire, carbon, cremare, this batholith of quartzite enveloped in mica schist. Most all of our dates have been in my sitting room, love flames in place of hearth. Hestia gave herself to Vesta. Meteorites fell from the same named asteroid. Earthly carbonaceous chondrites, say it, contain chemistry, twinning Vestal waters. Earth's liquids accreted in a dance with its rock. You find me too a wet planet, with all your hard Dalmatian promontories and hurt pebbles and heat. We are sun-eyed in furs, pieces of nature this moment. We talk about the first ever stream and the first ever rain. This head was formed from the very push of Pangean plates that appled Appalachians, birthed Susquehanna that sounds so like a whisper. Passion is an argument, dumping 71 inches of rain on La Reunion, far-flung cyclones. Our love is heady orogeny, buckling and folding us and rising up, defying erosion. Let that come later. Today, sphagnum runs our limbs, rayleigh scattering glistens our irises, eskers, acclivities mould us. No burra, no mistral or sirocco disturbs new neural pathways now. We are streams, rains, a deluge into each other's hearts.
And that's Ingrid Casey. Yeah, Ingrid Casey there with her poem, After Lockdown, A Walk on Brayhead, and that is the winner of this year's Waterford Poetry Prize. This was a very strong love that blossomed. Tell me a little bit about the book swapping and how this love started to grow.
Well, I don't know if any of the listeners there, or anybody in studio knows the terrible world of online dating, but when people were in lockdown, they were extremely bored, and obviously everybody was chatting to each other and forming alliances, but nobody could really go anywhere. So I think that lots of people just accepted the fact they were stuck in a 5 kilometer radius and had to make do with that. So and obviously go by health guidelines. So all you could do was just go for a walk. But it did happen. It was the spring, so we were able to go for a walk, and we realized we were both very bookish type of people. So I had books here, and my now boyfriend, Ante, had very few books with him because he had emigrated here from Croatia not too long ago. So we decided to do the book swap, and he happened to have a, what's the Rupi Kaur book, who I'm not a fan of, actually. So that has become a bit of an in-joke between us now. But I had a collection that I had edited, so I must have seemed very fancy. I didn't feel very fancy. But we had a bit of crack with it, and it just kind of went from there. So, yeah. So he's great. So that was where it started.
So that's how it all started. And I'm delighted to say, by the way, that you don't have a poetry voice. Your voice is the voice that you use in your poems as well.
Oh, thanks very much. thank you very much.
Colm, what Ingrid tells us there, you had none of that background, because it gives such an added layer to the poem when you hear that background with the book swap with her neighbour and love growing out of that. What does that do to the poem when you hear that after the event?
Well, you always, like Billy Collins famously said, you have the poem and then you have the interpretation, and sometimes they just don't marry up at all. Mm. But like they say, that, you know, the shortest distance between two people is a smile, but sometimes a poem can be this beautiful bridge. And what I got, like, you know, in these desperate times, these lockdown times, I was sitting there and I was just relieved and overjoyed to see that love didn't stop. You know what I mean? And that this poem is just this beautiful celebration of a new international relationship that formed the way mountains formed, you know, and it's full of amazing imagery and even the elements. I didn't really see that, you know, Ingrid says that to me now, but that wasn't something that I appreciated in the poem. We had my own set of criteria that I was going.
But I heard you saying when you were announcing the winners in that online event, I heard you saying there you felt something international off it without kind of knowing why.
Yeah, well, it's there's huge control in the poem, and right from the start when Ingrid says she's almost like the person who draws the screen and pitches a movie at you. She's like, think of, and then when she does that to you, it's like it cracks open your brain and she pours all this beauty in. You know what I mean? And right there in the middle of it, like, she's hinting at the Dalmatian promontories, which are over to the east of Europe and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so you start to see, wait a second, little, it's an international relationship.
Yeah, a little nod towards Croatia for certain. Ingrid, you mentioned Ingrid, that your debut collection Mandible came out in 2018. What's the situation now? Obviously, winning this poetry prize must be a huge encouragement to you. But where are you at now in terms of maybe moving towards a new collection or what's happening?
Yeah, definitely. I think what has happened since 2018 is I just sort of continued submitting to. I'm like very actually lazy about doing that, but I have submitted to. When I look back, it's, you know, 3 years nearly have elapsed now, but I do have other pieces. I did a really cool project with an artist, a visual artist called Yvonne Higgins. She had, it was a master's degree. She was doing collage show in like her end of year show in the Dark Room? It's a place in Stony Batter, I think, a photography studio. So she has a friendship with my publisher, who's an Irish academic who works in the Sorbonne in Paris. His name is, I can't think of his name now, Matthew Staunton. So he's the Onslaught Press. I should know the name, my publisher, shouldn't I? I was put on the spot there. I haven't actually spoken to him in a while, but he asked myself and several of the poets that work for him to interpret these murals that she had done. So I loved that. It was a journey of childhood. So I had a poem in that that was about Jackson Pollock as a child. I've done some poetry with Banshee, who I adore. I love the girls. I love Claire Hennessy, the girls who run Banshee. They're fantastic editors. They've always been great supporters of my work. Well, and I had also edited this anthology of young Irish poets that was translated into Greek. So I think there's scope for a second book for sure.
For sure. And the Croatian translation, I presume, will be fast on the heels of that second collection.
I hope so. He's definitely smart enough to do it. And it's really important to get a translator who knows what they're doing as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
That's something I've learned.
Ingrid, continued success with the poetry and continued joy and love as well. That's Ingrid Casey, the winner of the Waterford Poetry Prize for her poem After Lockdown, A Walk on Brayhead. And with me in studio, the judge of that prize, Colm Keegan. That's our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Paddy Carney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. I'll be back with you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1.